All right, Isabel, say a quick hello.
Hello, I'm Isabel, and I'm 5 years old, and I hope you enjoy our podcast.
Quiet now. You need to be really quiet for a minute, okay?
Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University. This is episode CXLIII, Damnatio Memoriae. If an emperor had been disappointing, cruel, tyrannical, or just related to the wrong person, he is at risk of being damned, erased, having his likeness destroyed, and his name stricken from the records. The process of Damnatio Memoriae was intended to be a permanent judgment, and the final vengeance of an angry Rome. Here's Rhiannon Evans.
Damnatio Memoriae is a Latin phrase that means the condemnation of memory, but it's not a phrase that exists in antiquity. Those two words exist separately, but they don't come together as a phrase in classical texts.
Mm.
In terms of what happened with what we call Damnatio Memoriae, is it's sort of like erasing someone from history, but doing it in very physical ways. So you would get rid of their face from a statue, you get rid of their name from an inscription, take them out of official accounts of something happening. So some people have reasonably, I think, made the parallel with, I guess, more extremist, maybe communist or fascist rewritings of history,
mm-hmm.
whereby you just exclude certain people or exclude certain accounts because they don't fit with your narrative.
Right, so calling it damnation isn't really an accurate voicing of what the process is. Erasing is more of a...
Yeah.
You're not saying you are going to hell and you're going to rot in a pit of fire with lots of... hands pulling you down for the rest of eternity. It's you didn't exist.
It's more to do with the other use of the word damnatio, which means a sort of loss.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess damnation means you've lost your soul.
Yeah.
So it comes through that root of that word rather than the way we use damnation and condemnation now.
Mm-hmm. And the general way it's expressed is by removing statues, destroying statues, changing statues,
mm-hmm.
Later on coins, and removing names and references from public faces, places, depending on how thorough you want it done.
Yeah, so it's a kind of literal erasure, although as we'll see, the Romans are often very practical about this. So rather than just having this faceless statue or completely destroying it, they might well just recast the statue as somebody else, because why waste it?
Yes, and much like deification, the main context that we know this from and that it was applied to was for Roman emperors or those who were quite important but didn't do such a good job.
Yeah, who were unpopular
and
unpopular with those who came after them in particular. So it's not always, but often with a change of regime, the previous emperor might suffer damnatio memoriae. And I think we know more about it with emperors. I mean, emperors are important, but the way they're remembered is important. So it's more likely to happen to them if they're unpopular. It's a process that had happened to other people and continued to happen to other people, but we tend to know less about it from the earlier period in particular.
So we started our last episode of deification by going, right, what were the non-Roman origins of deification? So how does that kind of thing extend to damnatio memoriae? Were there instances of this going on, or were there just similar practices that we can draw parallels with?
So we can see similar processes in other cultures around the Mediterranean, in Egypt and Greece, which tend to be the cultures that we have more evidence for, there's been more investigation into.
Mm.
And it's kind of the usual suspects that you might think that we had evidence of. So the pharaohs seem to sometimes have covered up the reigns of people who went before who were a problem in some way, such as the rule of Queen Hatshepsut in the 14th century BCE, or Akhenaten, who is the pharaoh that everyone talks about, isn't it? Because he tried to bring in a whole new religion.
Yeah.
And just have the one god, which didn't really go down well with a pantheon of gods. I guess more extreme figures, you might just try and wipe them out of history and start again or get back to where you were before. We don't have a whole load of ancient Greek instances, but there is a famous example of someone called Herostratus, who in the 4th century BCE set fire to the Temple of Artemis in Ephesus, which is one of the wonders of the ancient world.
So that's one of the wonders of the world.
Yeah.
You don't want to set on fire.
No. So that was a way of kind of, I guess, erasing him from having done such a dreadful thing to such an important monument. But with the Romans, this makes sense, given what we know about the Romans. It's much more connected to something political and legal, because, of course, they were obsessed with the law.
Yeah.
And so it's applied more methodically. And once it becomes something official, and as we'll see, you know, the process at times seems to have been done unofficially, and then sometimes it goes by the Senate, which they can make it official, that you could then put out a proclamation that throughout the whole Roman Empire, all remaining statues, images, whatever of this person were to be got rid of.
Yeah, yeah. It sounds very much like the coin flip scenario for deification.
Mm.
So once they got used to the process, was it either deified or damnatio memoriae?
Well, it sort of looks like that with emperors. I guess once it becomes normalized for an emperor to become deified, if you don't do that, then, yeah, the flip side of that is damnatio. Because it's both about memory, about how you commemorate somebody and continue. If you're a god, then you're going to have a temple and a priesthood and a cult and rituals, and that's a way of remembering that emperor. And if damnatio is an attempt to get rid of them completely. Early on, there are emperors who are neither. Like Tiberius is the famous one, I guess, who is not deified, not damnatio either. He's not very popular, but finding the feet days of the Principate, I suppose, and he slips between the lines there. But you're quite right, they are the flip side of one another, and the Romans, even though they don't always use a phrase like damnatio, that's a modern phrase, they do use words that mean erasure. So we see a lot in Latin this verb radere. We get the word raise from it, you know, when you raise something to the ground.
Okay, yeah.
Right. Tacitus talks about somebody's name being raised from the fasti, from the official records. And he uses another verb, eximere, cancel.
Okay.
So to cancel the person's name out of the records.
So they describe the process, and we needed a handy catch-all bit of Latin to tell us what was going on.
I think the fact that it has the word memoria in it, though, is important because it hasn't worked. We remember these emperors who have suffered that, and we kind of go looking for them even more.
Mm.
But at the time, it's highly symbolic that this is a judgment on their reign.
I guess the more that we go through this episode, it'll become very apparent of just how hard it is to totally erase somebody from memory. But even then, the Romans didn't seem to try terribly hard as well. But anyway, so let's talk about damnatio memoriae during the time of the Republic. So before the process became very refined and more so applied to emperors, what instances do we have of it in Republic Rome?
Some people have suggested that this kind of process applies to characters like the Gracchi, those tribunes of the plebs who are both murdered, all right, Tiberius and Gaius Gracchus, murdered by the Senate, kind of lynched by the people. Their bodies are desecrated, Gaius in particular, and their houses raised to the ground, to use that verb. But at this point, there's no kind of erasure of their names. In fact, Plutarch, who has biographies of both of them, says that people regret doing that. So that seems like more of a kind of heat of the moment.
Yeah.
The enemies of the Gracchi just taking it out.
But they do carry out the hallmark processes of, you know, you would confiscate their property.
Mm-hmm.
You would burn down their houses.
It's more personal, though, I guess. It's difficult to say because we use the phrase damnatio memoriae like it was a thing, and actually it's a thing that comes into being very gradually. So to say this is what it was, and if they don't do all of this, if they don't wipe out their names and their statues and their likeness, then it's not that, it's not quite right. This is probably the beginning of that process.
And then you've got other instances such as, you know, like proscriptions that get carried out at various times. You're again doing the actions of things that would later on become part of damnatio memoriae. So you're confiscating property.
I mean, you're putting their name on a list, which means that people can get rid of them
Yeah.
with legal impunity.
Mm.
but is it made illegal to have statues of them anywhere? I mean, it might be unwise.
Yeah.
But if you had a personal little shrine to one of those people who was on a prescription list, might be able to get away with it. There's a more kind of concrete form of this, I guess, with Mark Antony, who's erased from the Fasti Consulares, so the lists of the consuls in 47 BCE, but seems to be rehabilitated later.
Yeah, because I guess, well, you know, you've got somebody like Claudius who traces his lineage back to Mark Antony and seemed quite proud of that.
Yeah, exactly. So, his mother is the daughter of Mark Antony.
Yeah.
Caligula is another generation down, but again, related directly back to Mark Antony.
Mm.
I mean, there's a sort of an interesting process going on during the time of Augustus and the way he talks about people like Antony.
Yeah.
In that he might not mention him by name.
Mm.
He just calls him the one against whom I waged war.
That's in the Res Gestae. Yeah. He just kind of obliquely refers to him without naming him.
Yeah, and he talks about a faction that he's liberated Rome from.
Yeah.
It's almost like by omitting the name, people know even more strongly that means Antony.
Mm.
There's a complicated process going on there too, because part of that is not wanting to call this a civil war. So call it a faction, and yeah, it's a Roman faction, but they're not representing your mainstream Roman. They're outsiders, even though Mark Antony was very much an insider.
Yeah.
But he's sort of depicting him as someone a bit other within Rome.
The time when this really gets refined then, I suppose, as a bit of a process is when you get the bad emperors. So you've got Tiberius, his father is deified, as we covered in the previous episode, but he is still using essentially the tools of the trade against his enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's not erasing them.
This is why it's quite culturally and temporally specific. So it seems from all the evidence we have that Tiberius was quite a paranoid character. And one of the ways that he dealt with what he perceived to be enemies and those plotting against him was by having spies, basically.
Yeah.
And the delatores, people reporting back to the emperor and dobbing people in, to use an Australianism. And
I get what you mean.
And that some of them would be forced to kill themselves or executed or sent into exile and then left there to starve. And as a way of finally almost taking revenge on them, this wiping out of their memory might happen. Yeah, it kind of starts to gather speed under Tiberius, but it's a very particular circumstance where he also either manufactures or manages to bring into existence a whole load of enemies.
Yes.
So there's a purge going on.
We get quite a few examples of people who are purged under the rule of Tiberius.
So a famous case under Tiberius is the governor of Syria, Gnaeus Calpurnius Piso, who was accused of poisoning Germanicus, might have been made a scapegoat for this, we don't know. He is then condemned for this, and we actually have the Senatus Consultum Ultimum, the decree of the Senate from 20 CE, by which he was erased from history, as it were.
Okay, the sanctions against Piso and his family included that no lamentation on account of his death be undertaken by the women by whom he ought to have been mourned according to ancestral custom. Statues and portraits and masks of Piso, whenever displayed, be removed. If anyone of that family of Piso, or any of those related by blood or marriage, etc., etc., died and was to be mourned, that the portrait of the elder Piso not be carried amongst the other portrait masks with which they customarily celebrate the rites of those funerals, and that his portrait mask not be placed among the portrait masks of the Calpurnius family, and that the name of the elder Piso be removed from the inscription of the statue of Germanicus that was erected to him in the Campus Martius next to the altar of Providence, and that the property of Piso be confiscated, and that these lands be returned to Tiberius Caesar Augustus our princeps. That's really quite thorough, and everything that we associate with Damnatio Memoriae.
Yeah, it's comprehensive, you're right. It's like everything we can think of
yeah.
for getting rid of him. and ending with, and Tiberius gets his property.
Yeah.
So that's quite handy too. But something that we should have mentioned, and that brings out nicely, is that, and this is really important to all Romans, it's not just the public dimension of this, but that their likeness can't be carried in funeral processions anymore. So it's like they don't even exist to their family.
Mm.
So because this is a way of keeping your ancestors alive, having them brought out for funerary processions and marched along these statues or funeral masks. It is damning, as
yeah,
it were.
Yeah. There's a bit more text in, this is in Tacitus, though. At the same time shouts were heard, it was the people at the Senate doors crying that, if he escaped the suffrages of the father, they would take the law into their own hands. So they really wanted Piso to pay for what he'd done. They had, in fact, dragged his effigies to the Gemonian stairs and were engaged in dismembering them when they were rescued and replaced at the imperial command.
Right.
Dismantling of effigies, the Gernonian stairs, that's all part of damnatio at some point, isn't it?
Yeah, and the Gemnonian stairs are the stairs of lament where executed criminals were thrown into the Tiber. So they're associated with shame.
Mm. We'll come to that as well because that comes up again. But I guess besides Piso, the really famous implementation of this by Tiberius is of Sejanus, who at one point seems to be the one who's going to succeed Tiberius if he had his own way, depending on.
It looks like he was certainly trying to make strong links with the imperial family through Livilla.
Mm.
And, you know, Tiberius, you could say, we've talked about this elsewhere, but had brought this on himself by gone off to Capri. So Sejanus was left in charge as Praetorian Prefect for a long time, from 14 until 31 CE when his fall comes. And, you know, he's kind of the gatekeeper to the emperor. He is seen as someone who's plotting behind the scenes to take over from the emperor. So he is officially tried in front of the Senate. He's dragged to the Senate and he suffers this humiliation and they decide that the damnatio should apply. So this is from Dio Book 58. The populace assailed him, shouting many reproaches at him for the lives he had taken. Sejanus has been part of this purge, very much so. And many jeers for the hopes he had cherished. Wanting to be emperor. They hurled down, beat down, and dragged down all his images, as though they were thereby treating the man himself with contumely, and thus he became a spectator of what he was destined to suffer. For the moment, it is true he was merely cast into prison, but a little later, in fact, that very day, the Senate associated in the Temple of Concord, not far from the jail, when they saw the attitude of the populace and that none of the Praetorians was about, and condemned him to death.
Mm.
Notice they're very careful that the other Praetorians aren't there to defend him. By their order, he was executed and his body cast down the stairway. That's the Gemnonian stairs.
Yeah.
Where the rabble abused it for three whole days and afterwards threw it into the river.
Ouch.
His children were also put to death by decree. The girl whom he had betrothed to the son of Claudius, having first been outraged by the public execution, that means raped, on the principle that it was unlawful for a virgin to be put to death in the prison.
Whoa.
After that, it only gets worse. His wife then kills herself. Pretty nasty stuff. And you can see there, I think, if we can recover from the awful end of that quote, the process happening whereby, according to Dio, the Senate sort of sees almost an unofficial damnatio going on, the people just ripping down his statues and doing symbolically to them what they want to happen to him, this hated figure. Then they kind of carry that out officially.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of it's happening just out of groundswell. It's the anger of the people, but later on it's made part of a process. But this is almost like the toppling of a dictator.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyone who lived through the defeat of Iraq and the toppling of those statues of Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
Looks very similar, doesn't it?
Mm.
It's particularly marked here and that Dio wants us to remark that Sejanus is forced to watch this happening, because usually it would happen after somebody had killed themselves or been executed.
Yeah.
But Sejanus gets to watch it first, then he is executed, then he's kind of torn apart by the people. It's like every which way they can get at Sejanus happens.
Mm. So as a result of this, we have no portraits of Sejanus.
Hence, when I lecture on him, I have to show the picture of Patrick Stewart.
Oh, right. Okay. I would have just gone for the stairs myself. Maybe that's even too morose. But anyway, so his name is erased from public inscriptions. And this is the first recorded example of damnatio memoriae on Roman coins.
Mm.
So his name struck off those as well.
Yeah. that gives everybody the opportunity to either do or see this, their currency, they're everywhere. You see this scratched off and you know that this person has fallen from grace.
So then you get Caligula, who's not declared a public enemy when he dies. He's not deified.
Yeah.
He's not damned.
So Caligula, who follows Tiberius as emperor, is murdered in 41 CE.
Yeah.
He was a despised emperor. Obviously, he was murdered. The Senate lived in fear and really hated him. But he had only been there 4 years, although he'd managed to kill a lot of people in that time. And he came in as somebody who potentially would be loved because he was the son of Germanicus and Agrippina.
Dio spells it out that that's the only thing that saved him. That and maybe the military had lingering kind of affection for him as well.
Because he'd hung around with them as a kid.
But having said that, you know, hence the name of Gaius does not occur on the list of emperors whom we mention in our oaths and prayers any more than that of Tiberius, and yet neither one of them suffered disgrace by official decree.
That's Dio, book 60, chapter 4, subchapter 6. That's quite important to point out. It's like they're somewhere on the way to Damnatio, but it wasn't official.
Yeah.
And we should just mention that Gaius is the official name of Caligula,
in case
anyone's confused.
Sorry, yes. Caligula is our modern nickname kind of thing for him. Oh, well, no, ancient nickname. But having said that, you also had the same actions being carried out. So statues of Caligula were removed or reworked into Claudius. And you have examples of that if you want to Google it, where it's kind of like, that Claudius looks a bit off.
Yeah, you can kind of tell. Claudius seems to have had a wider face in statues that were intended to be of Claudius. Mm. There are still statues of Caligula, all right? So we have portrait statues. So they didn't get rid of all of them, but it can be harder to find those images of Caligula.
So Nero, what happened to Nero?
Now, when we get to Nero, who attempted to kill himself, but basically had to be killed by a slave when he realized the army was coming for him in 68 CE. Now, we're not told by the sources that we have, primarily Suetonius and Dio, that he was officially given damnatio memoriae, but it certainly seems to have happened to his statues. So lots of his statues were recut. Vespasian, the next emperor who lasted any significant amount of time, had his colossal statue that stood in the doorway of his golden house recast as the face of the sun god. So Nero's head was taken off it. Again, why would you waste a massive, colossal bronze statue, turn it into something that your reign could commemorate? And with the emperors of the civil war period that leads to Vespasian being emperor, it's a similar process. Mm. So it's not like the Senate. They probably wouldn't have had time, to be honest. We have four emperors in a year, remember? They didn't bring a damnatio memoriae forward, but the archaeological evidence suggests that there was a wipeout of their images.
Yes, yeah. And I mean, you know, they were only emperors for a few months each, but, you know, Galba was later on kind of rehabilitated. Otho was just damned. Vespasian was given the whole, dragged through the streets.
Yeah.
And then he was thrown down the Gemonian steps and dispatched of that way, which I think up until that point was the most brutal dispatching of an emperor.
Mm.
But after that, you've got Vespasian coming in, deified. Titus, 2 years, tick the box, deified. Domitian. Hello, Domitian.
No. Yeah. Yes, Domitian manages to ruin it all for the Flavians. Largely for those in control, what he does wrong is executing lots of senators.
Mm.
It's the traditional thing. And really setting up as much more like a king than previous emperors had. So having something that approaches a throne room, setting himself up literally higher. Mm. So, and you know, there were rumors that he called himself Lord and God. That appears in Martial's poetry. A very unpopular emperor in many circles, particularly for extravagant building. So those who were with us, I guess, quite near the start of the podcast process now, way back when we looked at Domitian, might remember that there was a graffito that objected to the number of arches he built, which was a brilliant Greek pun.
It's just like enough, wasn't it?
So arche in Greek means enough.
Yeah, on an arch.
But in Latin, too many arches.
Yeah.
He was killed in a conspiracy, killed by assassins, stabbed to death. His body wasn't mutilated. So we've had a lot of mutilations and bodies being treated like those of criminals. He was actually cremated and his ashes were put in the Temple of the Flavians with the previous emperors, his relations.
Yeah, but he was kind of like snuck in there as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
It wasn't a grand burial procession with the populace crying or anything like that.
Mm.
So is what sets this apart as an actual damnatio memoriae, because he is damned, is a Senate decree?
It is. Okay. Yeah. So this is an official decree of condemnation by the Senate.
Okay. So now they've got their process worked out. This man is damned.
Yes. And we see that reflected in what Suetonius has to say towards the end of his biography of Domitian. So Suetonius tells us that the people of Rome were kind of indifferent. And then he goes on to say in chapter 23 of Domitian's life, the senators, on the contrary, were so overjoyed by Domitian's death that they raced to fill the house, that is the Senate house, where they did not refrain from assailing the dead emperor with the most insulting and stinging kinds of outcries.
Mm.
They even had ladders brought and his shields and images torn down before their eyes and dashed upon the ground. Finally, they passed a decree that his inscriptions should be everywhere erased and all record of him obliterated. And that erased word is that verb I was talking about at the beginning,
yeah,
or a form of it, eradere. All right, so completely got rid of, like rubbed out, scratched out, almost means.
Yeah, I see it there.
Yeah, and obliterated comes from a word that looks like our word abolish, abolenda. So got rid of, thrown out, taken away. And there are lots of great verbs there. Assailing the emperor, they use the verb lacerare, which means lacerate, we get from it, tear up.
Mm.
So there's lots of tearing down, tearing up, throwing out, scratching out verbs in this description. And it does happen officially. That is the important thing here.
It uses the word decree. That's going to be carried throughout the empire.
Yeah. And unlike other cases we've seen where, as you pointed out, you get this kind of surge from the people, this outcry, and then maybe the Senate reflects that.
You've got to hear the people not really being bothered by it. Yeah.
It's the other way around. So now the Senate is taking charge of this process and leading it, at least in this case. And we know that this did happen. His name, Domitianus, was erased throughout the empire. Not everywhere, but about a third of inscriptions were affected by this, that we can tell that his name was got rid of.
Okay.
His statues, and you really can tell this because the next emperor, Nerva, only lasts 2 years.
And he was quite an old man.
Yeah. I don't know if there are any brand new statues of Nerva.
Yeah, it's just re-sculpting kind of thing.
But we definitely have some that are re-sculpted from Domitian.
Mm.
And even at taking over, this always seemed like a bit of a cheek to me. Domitian was in the middle of building a new imperial forum with a temple of Minerva in it. And Nerva just takes it over and calls it the Forum of Nerva.
And that's still what it's called now. Yeah. Yeah. The flip side to this, I suppose, is that in the last example of Damnatio Memoriae that we went through, Sejanus, his family were also dealt with really quite harshly.
Very brutally.
Yeah, but that doesn't happen to Domitian's wife. Yes. I'll say that much. She's left alone and kind of honoured.
I mean, she lives on quite a considerable time into the reign of Hadrian, who's three emperors later.
Mm.
Yeah, she continues to be honoured and portrayed in statue form and is remembered in a public inscription as Domitia Augusta. So Augusta, you know, means honoured, revered.
So now we're going to fast forward through history a bit because you do have five very good emperors who, you know, you
exemplary.
Wouldn't even think of damnatio memoriae.
All deified with no questions asked.
We get to Commodus. Commodus gets damned, later rehabilitated. But,
yeah.
You know, kind of.
And it's the pattern of murdered, therefore.
Yes.
Damnatio.
Yes. Which is fine and well and good. But I wanted to skip further even forward now to Geta. It's very hard not to notice that he was damned. So Geta was a co-emperor with his brother Caracalla. As soon as Septimius Severus popped his clogs off when he was in Scotland and left his sons in charge, it was never going to end well. But he thought that they would be a good kind of anchor co-ruler to each other. It didn't eventuate that way. And essentially, Geta is killed by Caracalla. Julia Domna kind of witnesses all of this. Sees one son kill the other.
I hesitate to say I like this one after you've described such appalling events. It is kind of fascinating because it seems entirely personal that this is a sibling rival issue.
It got to the point where they divided the palace amongst the two of them. They literally said, you have that half, I'll have this half, you have this staff, I'll have this staff.
You know, well, I think it's Septimius's fault and that he hasn't read his Roman history because we have seen this whole brothers sharing power thing go wrong on several occasions. I mean, Nero was meant to sort of share power with Britannicus.
I forgot all about that. That didn't last long, did it?
Britannicus, you know, instantly poisoned. Yeah. So what was Septimius Severus thinking?
He was thinking Lucius Verus, Marcus Aurelius.
Yeah, there had been one good example, yeah. I guess. But Marcus Aurelius is super special, as we know.
Yes. So Geta is damned by his brother. Not because he was a bad emperor, just because he didn't have the right friends. But because it's Caracalla doing the damning of his brother, it's visibly thorough throughout the empire.
It sort of looks obsessive, doesn't it?
Yeah.
To be that everything must all go. Because when we think of that phrase of obliterating someone's memory, if you refer to the previous cases we've seen, as I've said, you can find images of Caligula. We can find images of Domitian. Mm. It wasn't absolute. Whereas this does seem to have been absolute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we can see just in the city of Rome itself, the biggest arch in the Forum, the Arch of Septimius Severus, which has a very complicated inscription on it, but Geta's name has been rubbed out from that.
Yeah, a few extra words have been added to beef up how great Septimius Severus and Caracalla were, but it's simply to bridge over the fact that a name has been removed from there.
It's like getting your tattoo redone after you've broken up with the person whose name was on your arm or something.
The other example, I guess, that you see when you type in Damnatio Memoriae into a Google search engine and look at the images is the family portrait of Septimius Severus with his wife and two kids and one of the kids being scratched out.
Yeah, the face is just missing.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, this is the image that should come up when you type dysfunctional family into the internet, I think. It is a dynastic family portrait that has been defaced because that one character, and you can see it there literally scratched out. It's different from an inscription when the face is just missing. And of course, it hasn't been recast into someone else's face. He is just this faceless gap. The fact that you'd leave the other three, that this could continue to be a representation of a family with that hole in it. And it's fantastic. I mean, it's I know Kaelin's been to see it.
We'd both
love to go see it in Germany.
It's in Germany. So this is Severin Tondo. Oh. And apparently analysis was done of the scratching out bit and it seems like it was smeared with excrement, which is just an extra bit of damning there, I suppose. So for the next, you know, few hundred years of the Roman Empire, it pretty much, and this is what we see with deification, it falls into that happy pattern of either you're deified or you're damned. Much like deification, is the end of this entire thing Christian?
Pretty much. I guess the idea of rule and where rule comes from changes with Christianity. The idea that now the authority for an emperor's rule comes from God.
Yeah.
Which kind of changes the relationship between emperor and people and the position of the emperor. And of course, you also got building up over the decades and centuries the form of damnation that we would associate with that word.
Mm.
So there's a different place for bad people to go.
Yeah. But I suppose as well, the tools of the trade are still there to enact. So when you topple a dictator, you pull his statues down, you can recast them. You can even Photoshop people out of images and deny that they were ever in places or in positions of power. I guess ultimately what I want to know at this point is that we know that this was a process. The Senate would decree that somebody is damned, that their names be removed, likenesses be pulled down, that they aren't honored in family rituals. So why do we know even more about it than we would? Why is Suetonius and the historians writing about these people despite the fact that they were damned and there was a Senate decree?
Yeah, that's a good question, isn't it? Why would you then write someone's biography?
Yeah.
I guess this is not something that I've thought about. It is actually a good question, but Suetonius's agenda is different. In a way, it's a whole other strand of Roman historiography and biography that is to warn people, to show them negative examples. From our favorite piece of fake news from antiquity, the Historia Augusta, the Augustan history, which, as we know, is a tortured text in that we don't know exactly who wrote it. This is the quote from The Life of Aurelian, chapter 42. "Now, what shall I say of this? That whereas so many have borne the name of Caesar, there have appeared among them so few good emperors." This is also quite a depressed text. "For the list of those who have worn the purple from Augustus to the emperors Diocletian and Maximian is contained in the public records. Among them, however, the best were Augustus himself, Flavius Vespasian, Titus Flavius, Cocceius Nerva, and the deified Trajan, the deified Hadrian, Antoninus Pius, and Marcus Antoninus, Severus the African, Alexander the son of Mammaea, the deified Claudius, and the deified Aurelian. For Valerian, though a most excellent man, was by his misfortune set apart from them all. Observe, I pray you, how few in number are the good emperors, so that it has been well been said by a jester on the stage in the very time of this Claudius, that the names and the portraits of the good emperors could be engraved on a single ring. But on the other hand, although that's quite a list to engrave on a single ring, if you ask me.
It's a very big ring.
But on the other hand, what a list of the evil. For to say naught of a Vitellius, a Caligula, or a Nero, who could endure a Maximinus, a Philip, or the lowest dregs of that disorderly crew? As I say, he's pretty depressed, whoever wrote this. I'm assuming it's a man. It might not have been. Somebody looking back at the list of Roman emperors does find it a depressing enterprise, because so many of them came out of it as autocrats or villains or, you know, just mass murderers.
Mm. And I guess if you only wrote about the good emperors, it would be a very short book.
Well, apparently.
Yeah. Before we finish the podcast today, a coda. Hello, Rhiannon.
Hey, Matt.
This is slightly different for Emperors of Rome. Our podcast is suddenly relevant to the modern day.
It's always relevant. Don't give me that.
But when we initially recorded this episode a few weeks ago, it was just before everyone started pushing statues over into the water and pulling them down and covering them in paint, which is essentially a modern manifestation almost of damnatio memoriae. Would you call it that?
I think it's similar to some forms of damnatio memoriae. I mean, it's been an ongoing issue, certainly with the Statue of Rhodes in Oxford. This has been a debate for a long time. I think that it's probably similar to what was happening in ancient Rome, in that some of those damnatios came up from the populace itself. They didn't necessarily come from official circles. So especially with those earlier emperors, with Caligula, for example, it didn't happen officially. It wasn't in Claudius, the next emperor's interests, for that to happen. But the populace kind of took it into their own hands to smash some of his busts and scratch on his coins. And also Nero, there's a famous scratched Nero coin. There was this urgency, this kind of release of anger, and maybe that's the wrong word for it, this release of tension after a despised emperor had died. And there's enough people, there's enough of a surge of feeling about his reign, that a similar kind of process will have happened. I say that in the knowledge also that it is different to the current circumstances, because often these people have been dead for a long time. And in some cases, the statues were put up a long time after their life. So the commemoration is slightly different. Whereas with our emperors, we do have some posthumous statues, but generally a lot of them will have been put up to honour the emperor while he's alive, especially in the provinces. So this is an outburst of feeling against somebody who might have been tyrannical. Therefore, you couldn't possibly do it when they were alive. But afterwards, there's that release of feeling. Now, the release of feeling now is the anger against the violence that has been, and other forms of harassment to people of colour in our societies. That kind of goes through all of these levels to anger with imperialism, which is kind of at the base of all of this. That obviously wasn't happening in Roman antiquity in general, unless you have maybe a group of people in the provinces that are unleashing against a particular figure, which does happen sometimes. Although, as we've seen, hated emperors like Nero, often popular in the provinces. So it's almost the inverse.
Yeah. And it seems like with these statues as well, there are people who are defending them and saying, no, they don't represent that. They represent this. They're important to our heritage. There would have been people in Rome saying that as well, wouldn't there? The army saying, oh, look, Caligula isn't such a bad guy. Maybe we shouldn't be pulling these statues down. There's going to be two sides to every story.
I think there are ways of telling this story. We can talk about the way that different groups had different interests here and different perspectives on it. So I think that the simplest way is to go back to that example of Claudius, who might not have had anything personally invested in Caligula, but he was his uncle, so it wouldn't have done any good for his dynasty to be seen to be wiping out, literally rubbing out, which is what Damnatio is, the memory of that figure. And in a way, he might have had more invested in trying to recuperate that early feeling of, you know, the golden boy coming to power of Caligula, and trying to, if you like, forget maybe the last couple of years of his reign. So I think that the important parallel, I think, for us is that there isn't just one narrative on these people, but for different groups with different interests, they might have stood for specific things. These statues are symbols, and in some cases, they're clear symbols of oppression for a huge group of people. For others, they seem to represent a certain type of stability, I suppose, normality. I guess the question is, do you really want to stick with that status quo? Is that what you want to commemorate?
And the other thing that comes to mind when I was reading about these sort of things happening recently is that some of the best preserved statues that you've got of Caligula are the ones that have been fished out of the Tiber. So maybe there's a there's an upside to statues being unceremoniously chucked in the water these days.
Yeah, the preservation through attempting to destroy or destroy or humiliate the memory of that emperor is an interesting one, isn't it? I've been thinking about this, and the scratching out of them, not only the throwing into the water, but that's an interesting case in itself, that that has actually preserved Caligula. But the scratching out is part of the history, right? Or the smashing of the face, or the turning the face into somebody else. So I think that if we take a longer term view on this, and looking at Rome allows us to do that, because it's from a long time ago what we're talking about, then part of what's going on now is going to be part of history. So we might want to think about it in those terms. It might be a history that we're happy with or unhappy with.
That's Dr. Rhiannon Evans, Associate Professor in Classics and Ancient History at La Trobe University, and you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you may cast your pod. Please leave a review. They help other people find the podcast, and I do read them and appreciate them. You can like the Emperors of Rome on our Facebook page, and you can follow both myself and Rhiannon on Twitter. Rhiannon is at Dr. Rhiannon Evans. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. In the next episode of Emperors of Rome, we have a closer look at Roman law and the jurist Ulpian. But until then, I'm Matt Smith. You've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.